Hi, Namulanta Kombo here, and I'm excited to tell you that my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a second season, and it's available now. Find out more at the end of this podcast.
This is Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. I'm Marnie Chesterton, and I'm in a warm and humid greenhouse at Kew Gardens in London. And I'm here surrounded by loads of really beautiful climbing plants because of a question about a climbing plant on the other side of the world.
I have a tree which stands some 15 feet high.
Meet Eric from New Zealand.
It puts out tendrils towards another tree some 10 feet away. There's nothing between the two trees. The tendril goes straight for the other tree. How does the tree send its tendril so accurately? It must have some sort of ability to sense. It has no organ that I'm aware of supplying that sense. Please tell me how this is accomplished.
Can I ask what type of tree it is? Can you describe it for us?
It's a wisteria.
So beautiful flowers.
Yes, yes. But the tendrils go out, and they always go out somewhere very specifically. It's very obvious. Whichever way they're going heading somewhere.
Do you think it deliberately can sense that there's something and it grows towards that, or is it just that it's growing anywhere where there's empty space?
No, it's quite clear. Any tendril that goes out is definitely going somewhere. It's not a haphazard thing, it's quite specific.
So, do you have an explanation? I mean, do you think that the tree can decide? I don't know, it sounds weird. Do you think the tree is doing a very slow version of putting its arm out in front of it?
I'm asking you because I don't know how this is accomplished. I can see what it's doing. I can't explain why it's doing that or how it's doing that. I have no explanation whatsoever.
I am very excited to go and investigate this because I'm a secret tree fan. Yes.
You hug trees, do you?
I was a tree surgeon before I did radio. I did tree surgery and I did botany at university. So the chance to go and ask anyone questions about trees is a delight. So thank you for this, Eric.
Oh, I think they're just fascinating.
Mariane Souza Baena is a Brazilian plant biologist. She specializes in climbing plants, so she can explain how Eric's wisteria decides to grow in a particular direction.
They are able to perceive the environmental signals, signs very well and modify their development, their physiology and everything about their growth pattern and find a support and wrap around it and then climb it very efficiently to find light, you know, to acquire more light, which is necessary for their proper development.
So they've got certain adaptations because they don't have the ability to support themselves or get where they need to be using their own structure.
Yeah, that's true, because they are not able to support themselves for long, like because they can support themselves when they are tiny, little seedlings. Perhaps some plants, even until they reach like more than 1 meter long, they are still able to support themselves. But after that, they just cannot do it anymore. And if they don't find a support to grab, they will fall on the ground. So they have to have this, to perform these broad movements with their tips. And with them, they search the environment for support, for a supportive structure. So they have to be able to move like that and like to bend their stems, to make the movement broader in order to be more successful to reach some supportive structure. So yes, they function differently from the other plants that are, for example, trees or herbaceous plants.
And does a climbing plant have specific bits that other plants don't that help it find this support?
Actually, they do, because they are really successful, like always. And they even can, like, if they find a support and they kind, I'm going to use this word here, but of course they are not like animals, or they are not, they don't have consciousness. But if they find a support, they grab it and they don't like it because perhaps the diameter is wrong or something is not good, they can unwrap their bodies from it and search another one.
Wow.
So, yeah. But how do they do that? Like, we actually don't know exactly. Like, in the last decade, I would say, people are more interested in investigating what is going on in terms of gene expression, in terms of hormones and signaling across the different parts of the plant to try to, you know, uncover what is going on. But actually, we don't know exactly.
Plants are amazing.
That's Ilya Leach, a scientist at Kew Gardens in London.
They are certainly, in a way, many ways, much cleverer than us because, you know, they're stuck in the ground and they have to survive in that one spot all of their life. They've got to find food, they've got to fight off predators, they've got to stop being eaten, they've got to attract a mate. You know, we would be dead in a few days, but a plant, you know, some can live for thousands of years.
Ilya Leach and Tom Freeth, head of plant records, are showing me some of the climbing plants in one of the many conservatories at Kew, home to the largest single collection of living plants. That's about 5% of all the plants in the world.
Climbing plants, many of them produce structures called tendrils, which are sort of growths out of the stem of the climbing plant. And these tendrils are specially adapted. They have the ability that when they are touching the plant that they want to grow around and to climb up, they trigger a response called thigmotropism. Thigmos meaning touch and tropism meaning to grow or move towards something. And that touch sensitive triggers a whole cascade of reactions, which enables the stem from being straight to start curling around the stem and to give it support so it can climb up higher.
Tom, you've got an example here. What is this?
So we're looking at a passion flower, species of passion flower, Passiflora. And this is a really, really good example of the thigmotropism that Ilya spoke about. The young tendrils will, if you look at them in time lapse, they'll whirl around looking for a support. And then when they touch their support, one end of the tendril will coil clockwise and the other will coil counterclockwise. And so one end grabs and the other end pulls towards. And if you look at any of the passion flowers that you grow in your garden, you'll be able to see this happening.
May I have a play?
You may.
It's really beautiful. This is like a tightly coiled spring. And yeah, one direction and another direction. So it just pulls the thing towards it.
So clever.
That's really clever. So do most climbing plants have some version like that?
Yeah, there's lots of variations on the theme. Some twirl, so they'll hit the stem and then the plant will lengthen on the opposite side that it wants to twirl around. So if it's twirling sort of counterclockwise, it'll lengthen on the side outside the pole, if you think about it, or the stem, and that will cause it to then grow round. I haven't tested this, but anecdotally, two species of wisteria, one twirls clockwise and one twirls anti-clockwise.
Okay, the big question, how? How are these climbing plants curling themselves round various things? What's their strategy?
I'm not sure about a strategy, but in terms of the underpinning mechanisms that enable them to do this, often they involve plant hormones, so chemicals that influence the development and the growth of plants. This is something which is still a lot of debate about in the science world, but one of the mechanisms which is thought may be responsible involves a plant hormone called auxin, which some people may have heard of because it's often found in rooting powder. And what happens is that when a tendril, for example, touches the plant that it's hoping to grow up, it triggers a redistribution in the amount of auxin. And the effect is that the cell walls of those cells on the outer edge start to loosen their cell walls more. And that means that the cells can expand and grow more than those which are touching the stem. And so you get the stem curving around. And it's that movement as it goes around, you get the tendril being able to climb up the plant.
So our listener in New Zealand, Eric, he's observed a wisteria 15 foot high and it's growing towards a tree that's 10 feet away. And he wants to know how it sends the tendrils so accurately. So have you observed this behaviour in climbing plants in Kew? What do you think the answer is?
Well, without observing Eric's case directly, can't say for certain, but what it sounds like, what we do know, is that the tendrils of plants and the stems of plants react to light. So plants consume light through photosynthesis, so they're very, very sensitive to light levels. And some of the work done shows that tendrils, when they're young, go towards light, and then when they're old, they go away from light. Moving away from light helps them find a host or a structure to climb up, and that's what we think might be going on with Eric's tree.
So light might be the key here. But how exactly does Eric's wisteria use light to work out where it's going? It turns out that plants, although they don't have eyes, are really clever at picking up light across the spectrum, including ultraviolet and far red light, neither of which we can see. And they do it using photoreceptors, a bit like the photoreceptor cells in the back of our eyes, only a plant's photoreceptors are scattered all over their surface.
So there is a family of photoreceptors which is present in all plants, which are called phytochromes. And these photoreceptors sense two wavelengths, red light that we can also see and far red light.
That's Christian Fankhauser, a plant biologist at the University of Lausanne. Something you should know about plants. They absorb the red light and they also reflect far red light. And that alone is enough to tell them an awful lot about what surrounds them.
Even before a plant is actually shaded by other plants, because of this far red which is reflected by these plants, it will sense that there is a neighbor growing nearby. And I think one reasonable hypothesis is that this is one part of the answer to your listener's question, because this far red which is reflected from this tree will presumably be sensed by this wisteria, and it will indicate to the wisteria that there is another plant not too far away from it, and that this might be a good direction into which it should grow.
Just to make sure I'm getting this, so each plant absorbs red light but reflects far red light. And so one plant can tell if there's another plant nearby from how much extra far red light they're picking up.
Yes, that's true. And if we think about this question of growing towards the support tree in this wisteria, in this case, it actually presumably uses this information to grow towards the shade, which is a little bit counterintuitive, right? But for that plant, it is important because it needs this support to then grow up. While in other plants, typically this signal will also be used not only to grow a little bit more, but then also to grow away from that direction.
And that suggests that this light is being perceived by the plant with a sense of direction, right? It can say the light's coming from north or
Yes.
this way.
Yes, and the major photoreceptor which is actually giving that information are not the phytochromes that we discussed now, which are receptors which sense red and far red light, but there are another family of photoreceptors known as phototropins. They actually control the directional growth of the plants. But these two classes of photoreceptors, through mechanisms that are not very well understood, cooperate to, on the one hand, control the extent of growth, and on the other hand, the direction of growth. So if I may make an analogy, you would have one of them is the steering wheel and the other one is the accelerator.
Okay, so one's the steering wheel, the other's the accelerator. That means the plant decides to grow in a particular direction. It sounds a little bit, Christian, like plants are doing maths here.
Well, that's what some people say. Yes, they indeed integrate a lot of information about their environment to take, you know, the best possible decision. And how that works is not fully understood. And it's probably also done in a very different way from how animals do these things, because unlike animals, they don't have a central nervous system where all of this information is typically computed to reach a new decision. Plants tend to be, how should I say, less centralized in the way they organize things. They act more as modules, let's put it that way. But somehow they also manage to do remarkably complicated tasks. And as we know, you know, they have basically conquered pretty much every spot of this planet. So they are successful. They manage to grow pretty much everywhere, even in places where it really doesn't look like it's a great place to actually live.
Clever plants. The fact that each plant absorbs red light and reflects far red light means that, in a garden, each plant can sense the presence of other plants in a way that is totally invisible to us, just because a space with lots of greenery will have different ratios of these two types of light. You're listening to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. I'm Marnie Chesterton. So, plants don't have a nervous system, they don't have brains or consciousness, but they appear to be able to make decisions processing complex information. Climbing plants can work out where to go and even change their minds. Not that they literally have minds to change, of course. Eric mentioned his plant seeming to know where it was heading, which is a puzzle. At this point, I want to introduce Silvia Guerra, a scientist at the University of Padua in Italy. She wanted to see how climbing plants, pea plants actually, go about attaching themselves to supports and set up an experiment using thin sticks and thick sticks.
We plant the seed into the pot, okay, and the plants start to grow, and we put from the beginning a stick in front of the plant.
Silvia and her colleagues observed that the plants actually changed their behaviour and the speed with which they move, depending on whether the stick is thick or thin.
They are faster when they have to approach to a thin stick compared to a thicker one.
So hang on, in the approach to a thin or thick stick, so it's sensing the dimensions of the stick before it's even reached it.
This is amazing. These results suggest the plants are able to perceive before touching the support.
So how's it sensing it if it's not touching it?
From our results, we can just suppose the possible mechanism underlying this process in plants.
So a plant may actually be sensing its support stick before we see it reach out to grab it. That may sound like telepathy, but one possible mechanism is via the subterranean parts of the plant. Silvia is convinced that roots play a key role, and, with the research team, designed a simple experiment to test this. She grew pea plants near support sticks and, at a certain point, lifted those sticks up away from the roots.
We just lift the wooden stick from the ground, and when the stimulus is lifted, plants are not able to localize the potential support.
When Silvia and the research team raised the support stick so it was only available to the shoots, the pea plant continued spiraling and then fell over. The research suggests that the roots are somehow sending information to the rest of the plant, not only telling it if there's a support nearby, but also what the dimensions are. So, Eric's wisteria may not only be able to sense that there's a tree nearby, but also the width of its trunk. There's one name that keeps coming up as I've been talking to scientists about climbing plants, and that's Charles Darwin. Not someone you might immediately associate with plants, perhaps, or climbing plants.
Everybody thinks of Darwin as a zoologist, right? We all think of him about pigeons and evolution by natural selection, and maybe about worms.
That's Sandra Knapp, a scientist at the Natural History Museum in London.
But actually, the highest proportion of books that Darwin wrote were all about plants. And he wrote two about the movements of plants, one of which is called, actually, to give it its title, The Movements and Habits of Climbing Plants.
Why was he interested in climbing plants as opposed to normal plants?
I'm not sure. He doesn't really say. I mean, he was interested in plants. He was really a kind of closet botanist. I mean, actually, if you look at plants at all, climbing plants are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, how do they do that? What do? How do they know what to do? How do they know where to put their tendrils? How does it work? You know, what are they growing towards?
Yeah, and I think which brings us nicely to modern day and our listeners' question in Eric in New Zealand. He and Darwin, it sounds like, would have been fascinated by exactly the same thing.
They would have been chatting for hours.
In my garden in New Zealand is a wisteria and it appears to know where it's going. And imagine that being the basis of a correspondence.
Oh, absolutely. I can imagine him writing to Darwin And Darwin saying, well, actually, I've been growing wisteria and hops next to my bed while I've been ill, and this is what happens. You know, it's so interesting because I think we often think of plants as being non-sentient, and there's lots of debate about whether plants have consciousness or whether plants don't have consciousness. But, you know, people didn't used to think that invertebrates had brains or were intelligent. And look at octopuses.
They don't have a brain as such?
They have a brain. They've got a brain.
It's decentralized.
It's decentralized brain. And plants don't have a brain that we recognize, but that doesn't mean that there isn't, you know, I don't know. You know, there's so many things about the natural world that we don't understand. And that's what I think is great about being a scientist, is that there's just so much that we don't really understand.
So I can look over at Eric's wisteria, heading confidently towards a tree that it can support itself on, and say, that's pretty smart. And I'm not wrong.
Well, it's this was the beauty of the way Darwin articulated evolution by natural selection, is that you can imagine two wisterias, one of which heads towards the dark, which is perhaps heads towards the dark. I mean, I don't really know how wisterias work, but let's say two vining plants, one of which heads towards the dark or something that is a support, and the other of which just kind of heads off in any old direction. The one that gets to a support is going to go up, have leaves that get the sun, photosynthesize more, flower, fruit, and leave offspring. Whereas the other one's just going to get trampled by deer. And so that's how natural selection works, is it's not so much that they're smart, it's that through the sort of chemistry that is regulated by the genes, those are the ones that survive and reproduce. So the thing about evolution by natural selection is it's not so much about survival, it's about reproduction.
Did Darwin come up with any theories about why climbing plants climbed? How they developed bits of them, their tendrils or not?
No, he just described them.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of natural selection, he does very much feel that climbing plants climb because it gets them closer to the light.
That makes sense.
Which, of course, makes sense. It's one mechanism, but you can imagine it's not the only one. That's why there's some climbing plants and other plants don't climb.
I'm back at Kew with Tom Freeth and Ilya Leach to talk about how clever these living organisms really are. And I've spotted something familiar.
There's one of these in my bathroom.
Christmas cactus.
Yeah. He's called Grandfather. Aww. He's 65 years old.
Well done.
And he spills out into the bath. So having a bath with Grandfather is actually... sounds weird, but yeah, he's almost as big as this.
I think this is where you come into the philosophical debate as to whether they have consciousness or not. It would almost be better if they didn't have consciousness, so you didn't have to have a bath with Grandfather. And also, literally, all of our horticulturists couldn't live with themselves if plants had consciousness. We joke that you have to kill a plant 3 times before you know how to grow it. So, yeah.
But they do. They have all their senses. They have all of these senses, and they have senses that we don't have, but they're not concentrated in particular organs like ours are. So it's a weird one, consciousness and plants.
Yeah. Can they think like we do? No, absolutely not. They don't have brains. They don't have a nervous system. Can they sense? Do they have behavior? Yes, absolutely. And it would almost be absurd if they didn't. How do they survive this long being rooted to the same spot for evolutionary timescale without developing these very, very acute ability to sense and react to their environment, albeit on a slightly different timescale to humans and mammals?
So we've got all of these beautiful blooms from orchids at our feet, but also a load of fantastic climbing plants climbing up the walls of this greenhouse. Can I get you to pick your favourite and tell me why?
My favourite group of climbers in here are the pipe vines, the Aristolochia, Dutchman's pipe, they're known as, for this shape here. Exactly. Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's great when names do actually what they're supposed to. It's a really, really bizarre floral trait that all members of this genus share. So this is a trap, like a carnivorous plant. And so if we dissect this, we'll take this down the middle, you have an opening there, which is lighter than the rest of the plant, and translucent. And so this lights up for the fly. And the fly goes down in here, and there's under a microscope, you can see downward pointing hairs, which are incredibly strong. And so the fly, once it's committed, it's not backing back out. And it comes down here into this chamber, which is called the utricle. And basically, the flower won't wither and die unless it gets pollinated. So quite often, you can pull these apart and find a load of dead flies in the bottom. So you can say that it's kind of indirectly carnivorous, because when the flower will die, it'll hit the ground, and then that'll rot away and feed the roots. And I just think it's this fantastic adaptation, which you can see in all of these plants. Now, it didn't think to do that, but it does it. You know, it's intelligence of a kind. Yeah, I just think they're amazing.
Thank you. That's fantastic. That's such a good story. Animals, nil, plant, one.
So, we've come a long way from our listener Eric's wisteria to the fly-trapping world of climbing plants. Scientists know some of the story, how climbing plants can tell when they're near other plants that might make a good support to grow on. Scientists don't know all the mechanisms, and the science unravelling these is new and ongoing. But I think we can safely say that climbing plants clearly do know where they're going and how to get there. They're supremely clever. It's just a different kind of cleverness from the human kind. And perhaps because they live at a different tempo, we just don't give plants the credit they so clearly deserve. Here's Christian Fankhauser.
I think we do underestimate them, and part of it is because plants are, I would say, slow. There are these beautiful movies from David Attenborough where he films plants and then passes these films in accelerated mode. And then if you look at the plant growing, it looks like a snake, you know, moving around in the forest. But you have to accelerate the movement to actually see the complexity of what is happening. And, you know, everything happens at a relatively slow pace in a plant. And so we tend to think that they're passive, that they're just sitting there doing nothing. Maybe it's just because we're not patient enough to look at them. We tend to believe that, you know, they are there helpless, just waiting to be eaten by whatever herbivore. But in reality, they don't, because otherwise the earth wouldn't be green, right? So they can defend themselves against all kinds of organisms. They can decide where to grow, how to grow, depending on the conditions. So, you know, they have really very sophisticated senses. And we have a hard time relating, right? They're so different from us. And so when you can't relate, it makes it difficult sometimes to appreciate the abilities that they have.
That's it for this episode of Crowd Science from BBC World Service. The question was from me, Eric, in New Zealand. The show was presented by Marnie Chesterton and produced by Joe Glanville. If you have a question on any science subject and you want answers from the team, why not email crowdscience@bbc.co.uk.
Just to say that the podcast Dear Daughter is back this week for a brand new season. Here's the host, Namalanta, to tell you more about the show if you don't know it, and what's coming up in season two. What do you want your daughter to know?
I want her to know from the time she's very young that she is her own person.
What does she need to know?
Despite our challenging life journey, do you know you were born into so much love?
Dear Daughter is a podcast creating a handbook for life, full of advice for daughters everywhere. And we're back for season two. More touching personal stories.
Dear daughter, I don't know what it feels like to grow up being as supported as you are.
More letters of advice.
All I can do as their parent is offer whatever wisdom I can.
And some very special guests, like best-selling author Isabel Allende.
My mother would tell me things that usually mothers don't share with their daughters about money, about sex, about her past, about her dreams.
That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.